And yes, we did just come back. As many of you know, we left right after the gathering on Sunday and hightailed it out to Tucson, or the area just outside of Tucson, Arizona, and got back Thursday late afternoon and immediately had to hit the ground running. It was interesting. I got in here this morning, and for some reason, nothing was set up. This room was empty. There were no chairs set up. Everything was piled on the stage, the courtyard. So we're screaming around. And then a little bit later, little Josie had a meltdown right there and just wailing away. And it's like, welcome back. From the silence, right back again, you know. But, yeah, it was a silent retreat. And we had a lot of fun with that. Or I guess a lot of people had fun with that on our expense, you know. In the days leading up to the retreat, are you really going to be able to be quiet? Are you going to be able to do that? You know, and then there were some people like, I'll embarrass Nina here. She looked at us with this wide-eyed, 3 days of silence? I could never do that. I said, well, sure you can, Nina. You know, when you're at home, you're silent. She goes, no, when I'm home alone, I talk to myself. I could never do that. And then, of course, as soon as we got back, I was looking, can you speak now? Is it okay? So it was a lot of fun with just the jokes and the lightheartedness of it. But, you know, the truth be told is, it's a very different experience. Very different experience. How many of you have been to retreats before? A lot of you have been to retreats, weekend retreats. How many of those retreats were actually silent? Okay, a couple of you have done that. Very different experience. Very different experience. You know, this one was very strict. I've been to lots of silent retreats before. I grew up Catholic, 12 years of Catholic school, joined a monastery, a religious order out of high school. And it didn't last long. I realized I didn't have that vocation. But, you know, coming to this one, it was different. Because it was further out on the edge of the desert, literally in the middle of a saguaro forest. In fact, TJ, you want to put that picture up? Just so you can get an idea of what the... Frank calls the prickly desert looks like. So we're in the middle of a saguaro forest, and it was set in the foothills of a low mountain range overlooking North Tucson, which is in a valley, so there's mountains all around, kind of ringed by mountains. But as you can see what the terrain looked like, you know, red rock broken up, saguaros everywhere towering over all this low scrub and Palo Verde trees and mesquite and so on and so forth. And so it was a real interesting and different kind of terrain to step into, kind of that alien sort of world. And the center itself was just a low set of prefab-looking buildings, all painted this real sickly green. I don't know what that was all about, but, you know, and they were connected by gravel paths, and it was pretty much what I expected, you know, pretty austere and very Catholic, you know. I don't know what it is about Catholics. They all decorate the same. You just walk in and you can see a Catholic room as soon as you walk in the door. It's so Catholic. Of course, crucifixes are a dead giveaway. But the interesting thing to me, I walked in the main refectory, the dining room, and it even smelled familiar to me. I don't know, there was just something about it just kind of brought back. It was comforting in certain ways, you know. So many memories just kind of came flooding back as I moved back into that environment. But I think the thing that was most shocking to me, at least, not about to Frank, was that when you're not speaking to each other, you start to get a feel and a handle for the power of the spoken word in our daily lives. Because when you are just thrown in with a group of people, I mean, the first thing you do is you introduce yourself, you get your names, and you start to learn something about people. And the focus goes outward. It goes to the other. In this situation, there are no introductions. After 3 days, we didn't know anybody's name, you know. And in fact, the people who were there, you know, was probably a small subset of those who want to go to retreats and retreats of this kind. And, of course, they were all very Catholic, too, and probably more experienced because you couldn't even get eye contact out of people. It was the oddest thing. We'd pass someone on the path, and, of course, my natural inclination is to look and wave and smile or something. And I'd look, and they kept their eyes down, and they just stayed. And it seemed cold, it seemed weird at first, and it's especially awkward at meals because the meals are in silence too. But after a day or two of getting into that rhythm, you start to realize that this is part of the honoring of each other's space. You know, it's a different purpose, a different intent. Not to go and to socialize and to connect outwardly, but to go and socialize and connect inwardly. And so it was very different as we kind of moved through this day. And and through the 3 days, and getting used to the routines because it was highly structured. You know, they started with prayer at 6:30 in the morning. And so over there, because the time change is a little different, that's in full dark. So you're getting up before dawn, you get to the chapel, and so on and so forth. And they have what they're calling centering prayer. And if those of you who are not familiar with centering prayer, it's a way of just resting in God. It's completely wordless. And there's a ritual to it. We all came in at our chairs, and they rang a bell, and we turned our chairs around backward, facing away from each other, and then sat down, and we bowed to each other to reaffirm their intent and their life and so on and so forth. It was highly structured. There were meditational walks around the perimeter between each session. And then after that, we said the office, and the office is a responsorial liturgy of the hours, the Catholics call it, that is said 3 times a day and once in the middle of the night if you're really hardcore. And so we would say the office, and then there was Mass. And it was wonderful for me to be back in the liturgy again. It felt like coming home. Of course, Frank is a Southern Baptist. He was struggling a little bit, you know. But even for me, it's been a while since I've been in the liturgy, and they've changed the liturgy. They changed the words around. And so I'm just trying to say my old thing that I've been saying since I was, you know, 5, and it didn't quite fit. But the funniest thing was that toward the end of the Mass, everyone says corporately the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father. And I knew what was coming because Catholics don't say the last line. Right, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory. So I'm just waiting to see what Frank's going to do. And we get to deliver us not from evil. And there's Frank, for thine. And then he stops. But it was really just an interesting experience to kind of get into that throw. And as I've been thinking about it, you know, there are so many things that have struck me. And when we try to get into a different space, it's grinding at first, and it takes us into a different place, and it's trying to help us to get into a whole different feel. But when you think about if you're going to do that, if you're going to go off, and especially for the monks and the religious who do that as a way of life, one of my heroes is Thomas Merton, who joined a Trappist monastery in the early 40s and wrote books and became one of the leading and most influential writers of the 20th century. And his whole thing was to get away from the noisy life, get away from the craziness of his life in New York in the 30s, and went out into the fields of and the hills of Kentucky to find his silence, to find this place of solitude and contemplation. And Merton literally says that by doing this, monks and nuns, men and women who go off into seclusion, into cloister, and find silence and live this contemplative life are literally saving the human race. And the idea behind that is that by raising human consciousness, by raising it up, even in these isolated places, it's raising the collective consciousness of humanity. And at some point will be the seed, the fire that turns society around, turns our world around. Now, I don't know if that's exactly true. I mean, it could be. I'm not going to dispute Merton. But for me, that macro context was much less important to me than the intensely micro context in which we were being immersed, in which I was immersed when I was in the novitiate or in the first year. Because what happens to us individually, even if it has a corporate effect at some point, it starts from the inside and it has to move outward. And so what happens to us individually is really of importance. But why silence? You know, we live in such an unsilent society. Our lives are anything but silent. They're noisy. What is it about silence that is so important? What is it about silence that men and women for thousands of years have dedicated entire lifetimes to coming out of society, to seclude themselves in cells, small rooms, places where they can just practice this complete silence and this contemplative life? What is about that that's important? Is it important? Now, is it just important to them, or is it important to us as well? We, here, living our lives the way we do, is it important for us to practice silence? And how do we do that? I mean, we can't go off and, you know, we went off for 3 days and I about had to pop a blood vessel to get out there with so many things going on. And then you know how it is when you come back from any kind of time off. The desk is piled up and things are happening. You know, how do we do that? How do we find silence in our noisy lives? Is it important for us to do that? You know, these are the key questions that I've been asking for the last week. And I don't know if I can exactly convey what it is I want to convey today. I'm going to try my hardest. But it is a nuanced kind of message. And maybe a place to start is with Martha and Mary. And most of you probably know the story of Mary and Martha in the New Testament. And for those of you who don't, we're just a refresher. Jesus pulls into town, a little small village. And by pulling into town, I mean he walks into town, you know. He walks into town and a woman comes up to him in the village named Martha and she implores him to come to her house and he does. And being the good Eastern hostess that she is, of course she has to serve them and do everything for them, prepare the food and prepare the meal. And Jesus is sitting in the room and there's people listening to him and he's teaching and Martha's flying around doing the things she needs to do. Meanwhile, her sister Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet with the men and with the guests and listening. And finally, Martha can't stand it anymore and goes to Jesus and complains. You know, Lord, can't you see what's going on here? You know, don't you care that my sister Mary is not doing anything to help? Tell her to help me. And she gets a very soft but very firm rebuke from Jesus. And he says, Martha, Martha, you're distracted by so many things. And yet only one thing is necessary. And Mary has chosen the better part. She will not be denied. It will not be taken from her. Now that story has often been used kind of to say, hey, you know, we got to stop being so busy. We just got to go over here and sit with the Lord. But you know, that's possibly true. And there are times that we need to balance our lives between activity and inaction, just being, the state of being and the state of doing. That's true. But really, when you think about the reason that Jesus rebukes her, it's not because she's doing what she's doing. That was necessary. In that culture, if you didn't tend to your guests, if you didn't feed them, if you didn't do everything for them, it would be an outrage. You would never do that. And Jesus doesn't expect her to throw protocol out the window, hospitality out the window. She is not being rebuked for her action. She's being rebuked for her distraction. That's the key. In the midst of everything that she was doing, she could not hold her center. She let the resentment build up. She was spinning with so many things, she couldn't be where she was, doing the things that she was doing and seeing how by doing those things, all these other people could sit at Jesus' feet and just be the gift that she was giving them. She couldn't see that because she was tied up in all of the things that she was doing, the distraction in her mind, not the fact that she was working. This is a really important lesson for us to learn. The silence that we seek is not just because we seek physical silence. The physical silence that Frank and I were experiencing this last week, the physical silence that monks and nuns have been experiencing in cloister for centuries, is only the beginning. It's not the goal. It is the tool. It is the technique that takes you to the interior silence. The exterior silence takes you to the interior silence. Once we find the interior silence, we can hold on to it. We can remain silent, attentive, aware, in our core, even in the midst of intense activity. That's possible. We can do that. Martha could do that. We can do that. We don't need to go out into cloister, but we do need to start practicing some physical silence in order to find our interior silence. At the beginning, it's kind of like training wheels on a bike. We have to put those on. We have to learn how to do it so that we can do it in the difficult times when we're being triggered, when things are so frenetic. And so both things need to come together. That means we've got to find times to be able to practice silence even as our lives move on, even as our lives go the way that they go. We can't change that. But that one thing that Jesus is talking about, the better part, can be chosen in any life. The monk's life, the hermit's life, is just one way of doing it. It's an intense way, but it's not everyone's way. I tried to go into a religious order, and I realized right off it was not my calling. I wanted it to be. I really wanted to be a monk. I really wanted to be able to do that. You know, I guess I was in love with the idea of being a monk more than being a monk. Because once you get there and you find out what's involved, you know, it's not so sexy, it's not so great. Basically, whatever you choose, you're going to trade one set of problems for another, you know. But what the operative principles of being a monk were can still be practiced. Before Marion and I were married, I had about 3-4 years living by myself. And I used those times. I was studying Merton. I was studying this whole practice. And I kept my apartment as silent as I possibly could. You know, turned everything off, no radio, no TV. I had my own structure up at 5 o'clock and running and then journaling and praying and meditation. And then at 8 o'clock when the business day started, okay, I started working the phones and doing what I had to do. But everything stayed silent because I was working primarily from a home office. And then in the car, maintain that silence. And so I was actively doing that. It can be done. It's do we see the desire, the need for it, in order for us to put forth that effort to see if we can swim like salmon against the noisy current of our society and our lives. Can we do that? Is it worth doing? Action and inaction, being and doing, can we merge the two? You know, they had a library at the retreat center that I just loved. It was small, but it was just packed with the most relevant titles. There was a whole aisle section just on Merton, and they had all this great stuff and a video library, so there were DVDs and VHS even and different things, that titles that you would never see anywhere. I came across a title called Into Great Silence, and the other good thing about the library is it was usually empty, so I had the place to myself. But I found a title called Into Great Silence, and this is a documentary from 2005 that was done by a German filmmaker. And he had asked the Carthusian order, which is the most strict and ascetic order in the world right now. And their main abbey is in the French Alps, deep into the French Alps. It's called the Grande Chartreuse. And this order lives there in literal silence and solitude and isolation. And he asked the order if he could come and film what they do and make a documentary about it. And they said, well, we're not quite ready for you. We'll get back to you. 16 years later, he got a call. Okay, we're ready now. You can come. You know, when you're living this kind of lifestyle, time has a whole different sort of aspect to it. 16 years later, they're ready for him. But no crew, no lights, just you. And so he went to the abbey with just his cameras and his sound equipment, alone, and filmed for 6 months, lived with the monks for 6 months. And the documentary is just stunning. Now, I got to tell you, it's kind of like watching grass grow for an hour and a half. You really have to get into a whole different sort of mindset, because there's no soundtrack, no music, no voiceover, nothing. All he did was train his camera on what he saw in natural light and followed. And it was amazing what the photography was just so rich, and you're just holding sometimes on a single shot for a minute. I mean, you know how long that is? When you think of the way cuts go in media today, sometimes you'd be holding just on the side of a brother's head in deep contemplation and prayer for 30, 60 seconds, and then slowly move to another shot. And then there would just be a shot of a brother's face just looking into the camera, and then another one, and another one. So you got a sense of who these men were. And the young ones coming in and the old ones about to die. You know, it was amazing what these men do, how they dedicate their lives staying in that cell. Their food is even just put in a little, what they call a turn. You know, someone in the hallway opens the door, puts the food in and shuts the door, doesn't even go in and see them. The food just shows up in a little cubbyhole in their wall. That kind of isolation is just astounding to us. But in the midst of all that, they work. They all have manual duties, manual labor. They grow their food. They repair their shoes. They sew their own clothing. They're working at the same time that they're studying and they're praying. It's a busy life. And everything that they do during the day is highly structured. But it's all in silence. And I was thinking, In the same way, our highly structured life, with all the things that we can do, can still contain that core of silence if we intend for it to be. If we can carve aside some times for silence, but then bring that through all the other moments, it's possible it can happen. The question becomes, though, once again, why? Why silence? What is it that silence gives us that we need in the midst of our crazy lives? There was a recurring line in this documentary that would just be flashed on the screen, in French, of course, and they'd have an English subtitle. And just over and over and over again, he said, "Unless a man gives up all he has, he cannot be my disciple." That comes from Luke 14. Unless a man gives up all he has, he cannot be my disciple. And that would flash repeatedly through this hour and a half. What's Jesus talking about? What does it mean to give up all you have? Does that mean to sell everything, sell all your possessions? See, Jesus is putting his finger right on the issue. Unless you're ready and willing to give up everything that you have, you can't follow me. You can't go where I go. It's not a value judgment. He's saying, no, I'm not going to allow you to do this. He's just saying, you cannot go where I go. You cannot enter into kingdom as I experience and understand it and I'm trying to communicate it to you. It's not possible if you can't give up all you have. What does he mean by that? I want to tell you about my first day at the retreat because it was instructional for me. I roll into this retreat an experienced Catholic, even though I haven't practiced for a couple of decades now. You know, having been in a monastic order for a short time, you know, having been to silent retreats. And so I have a sense of I know what to expect and I know what to do. First thing that happens is Frank and I get there and there's this little old lady named Anne who is a volunteer and she's kind of running the front office and greeting the new guests. And she takes us on a tour and she knows everything about everything. She knows about the desert. She's telling us which plants are which and which ones to stay away from because that's not going to be a happy experience if you touch that. And then she's telling us, oh, don't walk here because that will disturb them. And here's a library and here's this and here's that. So she's giving us the whole grand tour. And the last place she takes us is to the hermitages. And Frank and I had booked hermitages. And they're at the edge of the property. They got 30 acres there where they, you know, just pushed the desert back. And here's these four dwellings. And I don't know what hermitage evokes in your minds, but if you just think a freestanding motel room, you got it. You know, it's just sitting there all by itself. And they take us to the first one, and it's at the top of a hill. And it's a really nice room. It's really bright, and there's great views out of both windows. And they had this really cool air conditioner with a remote control. And you push a button, and the louvers open, and then you turn it on. And it's like, wow, this is pretty neat. Then we walk down the hill to the lower one, and it's darker. And the eastern window is blocked by a stand of Palo Verde trees. There's no air conditioner in it. All of a sudden, I'm thinking, man, I really want the first one. Forget Frank. I outrank him anyway. I want the first one. And as soon as that thought hit me, it was like I was 10 years old again, trying to talk my little sister out of something that I wanted, because I used to do that regularly. Now I could get away with that. And here I was. You know, I've been a pastor for 11 years, you know, co-founded The Effect and doing all these things. I'm here on spiritual retreat, and what? I want that room? Are you kidding me? It was just amazing to me. That feeling would still come up, that I thought I had put a stake in the heart of those kinds of petty envies and desires ages ago. You know, so I'm feeling all this stuff, and I don't want Frank to know, of course, and he does now. So I give him the choice. Frank, which one do you want? And, of course, he chooses the one I want. So, you know, there we go. Did you know that I was feeling any of this stuff? See, I did a good job. I didn't let him know. And then I put it down, and I'm just trying to just relax about it and not go there. But it was a moment, and I realized, gosh, that stuff is still in there. Then she concludes the tour and tells us that there's about an hour and a half to the first prayer session, the next one that we're going to go to. So we go to our hermitages, and I'm settling in, and I set the timer on my cell phone so I wouldn't be late, because you can't be late to the group prayer sessions because they don't want you disturbing anybody by coming in late. And so they put a sign on the door and say you can't go there, so I don't want to be late. And I'm heading off, crunching up the gravel path to the chapel in plenty of time. And I see a pair of huge saguaros that look like they're holding hands. And if you want to see them, look at the picture in your bulletins, because I put it in there. And it was so cool. It looked like they're holding hands or standing arm in arm or something. And I'm thinking, I got to get a shot of that. So I get my cell phone and I will go up to it. And I squat down just to get the right angle. And the back of my jeans rip right up the side of one of the back pockets. It's like a bad sitcom gag. I mean, when does this ever really happen in life, you know? And so I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God. So as you're looking at that picture, just imagine me with my pants split, you know, squatting on my haunches in the desert. I think, oh great. Now I know that at the end of each prayer session, we're going to take this meditational walk around the perimeter. Imagine the person behind me trying to stay silent, looking at my underwear at every step. So I hightail it back down the gravel path to the hermitage. And by the time I get back, there is a sign on the door, prayer in progress. You know, don't enter until the sign is removed. And so I'm 10 years old again, late for class. All right, so I got a lot of time to kill. So I'm going to go down to the library. And here's that aisle with nothing but Merton. So I'm in hog heaven, just kind of looking at the titles. And one of the books catches my eye. And the reason it catches my eye is that it wasn't by Merton, it was written about Merton, but the foreword was by Henry Nouwen, who's another one of my heroes. And Henry Nouwen and Thomas Merton probably did more to help form my spiritual journey starting 25 years ago than anybody else. And so I picked up the volume, and I wanted to read what Henry said. And I want to read you just two paragraphs out of that foreword, because it struck me. Here's Henry Nouwen. "The only time I met Thomas Merton, I was struck by his utter earthiness. While on a retreat at the Abbey of Gethsemane, two students from the University of Notre Dame who had made an appointment to meet Merton at the lakeside asked me to join them. It was a very chatty encounter. We talked a little about abbots, a little about Camus, a little about writing. We drank beer, stared into the water, and let some time pass in silence. Nothing very special, profound, or spiritual. In fact, it was a little disappointing. Maybe I had expected something unusual, something to talk about with others or to write home about. But Thomas Merton proved to be a very down-to-earth, healthy human being who was not going to perform to satisfy our curiosity. He was one of us. Later, when I studied Merton's books, taught a course about his life and works, and wrote a short introduction to his thought, I became very grateful for that one unspectacular encounter. I found that whenever I was tempted to let myself be carried away by lofty ideas or cloudy aspirations, I had only to remind myself of that one afternoon to bring myself back to earth. When my mind's eye saw him again as that earthy man dressed in sloppy blue jeans, loud, laughing, friendly, and unpretentious, I would realize that Merton was and is no more than a window through whom we may perhaps catch a glimpse of the one who had called him to a life of prayer and solitude. Every attempt to put Merton on a pedestal would not only horrify Merton himself, but would also be in direct contrast to everything for which he stood." Wow. Here's my hero, so high up on a pedestal, drinking beer in sloppy blue jeans at the side of a lake, doing the most unspectacular things. And I wasn't still getting it. Even with those three incidents all in a row, all in the space of just a few hours, I still wasn't getting where this was driving. And then I came upon a collection of audio CDs that were recordings of Merton when he was teaching the novices at Abbey of Gethsemane. He was master of novices in the early 60s. I'd never heard his voice before. For all the books I've read and all the studying I had done about him, I'd never heard his voice. So I search all over the library till I find a CD player with a set of headphones, and I put it in and I'm listening. And in those headphones, I'm hearing this voice that I can barely understand because the recording is so bad, first of all. And second of all, it's a very unimpressive voice. Just a voice. A little monotone, a little pedantic, you know, he's just talking. But there's laughter punctuating. I couldn't hear or understand what he was saying all the time, but suddenly everybody would laugh, all the young men that he was teaching. And then he would laugh, and then he'd go back to talking. It was so unassuming. It was just a man speaking. And then it started to dawn on me what was going on. I started to connect the dots. I started to realize that what was happening here was a stripping away of what I thought I was bringing to this retreat. I thought I was bringing experience. I thought I was bringing, you know, myself as a pastor and a Catholic and these things. And all that was being taken away. You know, I'm still heir to these silly, petty feelings. You know, I can still split my pants and miss prayer. And then my heroes that are up on a pedestal are being brought back down to human size. And it started to make sense to me. Unless a man or a woman gives up all they have, they cannot follow Jesus. This stuff that we carry around, this stuff that we think is us, that we think we know, who we think we are the very things that keep us from the pure experience of this silence that the monks and the nuns are after, that Jesus is talking about in kingdom. If we carry these things around, we cannot go where he's going. Thomas Keating, Frank and I did watch a video of Thomas Keating, who is a founder of the Centering Prayer movement starting back in the 70s. And he has a story that he loves to tell. He always tells it when he's trying to get this idea of what centering prayer will bring to a person, what this practice of silence brings to you. And what he says it is working against the false self. See, every single one of us is wounded. Nobody gets out of childhood unscathed and unscarred. The woundings that happen in childhood, and we hope they're not too traumatic, but sometimes they are, shape us. We create strategies. We create programs for happiness, ways that we go about making ourselves happy, ways that we go about, you know, trying to just put a Band-Aid and comfort ourselves and make ourselves feel secure. We have all these programs that then inform us as to who we think we are. But it's a false self. It's not who we really are. It's just who we have learned to be. And so he tells the story of a young man who loved to drink his friends under the table. It was his crowning achievement to go into a bar and drink until everyone was passed out and he was the last one standing. And he would get this huge rush and this exultation that he is able to do it. He drank them under the table. And then he realizes the error of his ways. He realizes how vastly empty his life is. So he joins the Trappist monastery. And he goes in there and he does everything that they tell him to do. He's up at 2 in the morning because that's when their day starts. And he's doing everything that they tell him to do. And he's silent and he's working hard. And he is absolutely the model monk. And then comes the Lenten season, Lent before Easter. And they start the great fast. And he goes into the refectory with all the other monks and he's fasting and he's doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing. But after a while, he noticed that there are fewer and fewer monks showing up in the refectory because some of the older brothers, you know, they physically can't handle the fast. And now they're in the infirmary and they're feeling sick. And another one drops and another one drops. And right when he gets up to Easter and they ring the great bell, you know, when the fast is going to be broken, he looks around and he's the only one in the refectory, in the dining room. He had literally fasted all the other monks under the table. And he felt that great, you know, that great exaltation again. And so Keating says, what changed in that young monk? Nothing. Nothing. All he did was move from one side of the fence to the other side of the fence. But all his programs for happiness, everything that he learned about who he thought he was, remained intact. See, this is why it's so important to understand. It's not just going into a monastery that changes us, going through the routine that changes us. That's just conforming. That's outside-in stuff. And you can do that, and nothing changes in your life. Believe me, I saw that in the monastery myself. The men there were there for all sorts of reasons, most of which had nothing to do with spirituality, had nothing to do with a real intent for silence and connection with God. All sorts of reasons that come from our programs for happiness, come from the sense of the false self. And so a person in a monastery can be less changed than a person in our situation, in secular life, amidst all the craziness and the kids and the noise and the jobs and everything that we do. If our intent is right, we can change. This thing can happen out in our lives. We don't have to just go into seclusion in order for these things to happen. We can literally merge Mary into Martha in our lives. And Jesus is talking about this. If you take a look at Luke 14, it's on your programs. TJ is going to throw it up on the screens. This is the expanded verse of the one that kept appearing in that documentary. And listen to what Jesus says. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. What in the world is he talking about there? Then, whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And then he illustrates, for which of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has had a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it will begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. Anyone who does not give up all he has cannot be my disciple. Jesus is trying to get us right to the core of this thing. Anyone who comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters and even his own life, hate there means to prefer less, not a malicious hate as we think of it. Sana in Aramaic, to prefer less. In other words, to let go of the familiar, to start to let go of the security, the programs for security, the familiar life that we have, the way that we go about finding happiness, finding ways to move forward, include our family, the roles that we play, the jobs that we have, the finances. Can we start to step away from those things? Can we start to see them as less important, to prefer them less than the pure connection that's available in silence between us and our God? Can we start to do that? Can we start to see that they, in and of themselves, don't bring the peace that is missing, the peace that we yearn for? To let go of the security, to let go of the familiar. Who does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Literally, Jesus is telling us we have to move out of our comfort zone. We have to start doing the things that are difficult for us, not just the things that are easy, the things that we are used to. In recovery, there's a principle. It's called contrary action, opposite action. The programs for happiness are so ingrained in us, it's stimulus response, stimulus response. We are triggered and we respond. You know, I wanted the good room. Stimulus response. I feel that surge again. I thought that was gone decades ago. It's back again. They're so deep, we don't even realize it. Can you make a new choice in the presence of an old fear? Can you do that? Can you stop and take a breath and do the opposite thing that you're triggering, that your program would have you do? That's picking up your cross and following Jesus. Can we take a risk? Can we be the first one to lay down our arms, to drop our shields, to be the first one to pop our head out of our trench and be willing to be shot at so that we can bring the olive branch across to the person that we're having a difficulty with? Are we able to do that? Can we pick up our cross and follow Jesus? Can we take that contrary action? Because anyone who doesn't give up all he has cannot follow where Jesus is going. We need to expose the false self. We need to understand the programs for our happiness and how they just don't work. Not in the long term. They just keep us running like a hamster on a wheel. How do we expose the false self? How does that work? It works in silence. See, we think that maybe when we get silent, we think when we go into our centering prayer, when we have that God is going to speak to us. We're going to hear this voice. We're going to get this revelation. You know, so many times I've gone into centering prayer, you know, asking God, give me an answer to this specific question. I want it now. I've had people tell me, I'm going to pray until I get an answer. You know, and their eyes are all bloodshot and, you know, this vein sticking out of their neck. And, you know, it doesn't work that way. God is not going to perform to our expectations. He's not going to perform like a trained seal because we do this. It's not the way God works. God is always with us. He has already given us everything that we need. Every tool, everything we need to do exactly what we're here to do as human beings is available to us. The silence allows us to see that, to realize maybe for the first time that we already are worthy, already are accepted, already are available, have the permission to partake in all of this stuff that God has for us. The silence, not in the prayer session itself, starts a chain reaction within our spirits, within our very selves, where things come up out of the buried subconscious, and it's amazing how it works. Over time, if you will just show up to the process, whatever process that is for you, practice silence, you will start to remember things that were hidden and buried. Stuff will come, dots will connect. You'll see the connection between wanting a room and splitting your pants and seeing things in the library. Stuff will start to make sense to you, and you will be able to see what the false self is and choose something different. The silence works that way. Can you put it into your life? Yeah, you can do it. No matter how crazy your life is. Do you compulsively, when as soon as you get in the car, turn on the radio? Turn on the music? Turn on talk radio? How about if you just left it off? Some of you have long commutes. Some of you commute a half an hour, 45 minutes a day. That could be 45 minutes to an hour and a half of day of silence within your car with intention to connect. How about in your house? Is the TV always going in the background? Is there always music? Can that be turned off? Those of you with kids, can't turn them off. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. But they're not always there. Sometimes they go to school. Even at work, you can have moments. You have lunch breaks. You have times when you can reconnect with silence, even if it's 10 or 15 minutes. When you get up in the morning, can you get up a little early? Can you spend some time in silence? And you know what? It doesn't have to be anything specific. It can be just having a cup of coffee in the backyard, just watching the sun come up, but with intent, dedicated to God. Maybe it's reading. Maybe it is prayer. It really doesn't matter. But something that moves against the grain of the usual noisiness of our lives. This last phrase, this last passage from 1 Kings, and we'll end with this. This is where Elijah is hiding in the cave because the king's and queen's soldiers are after him. And God says to Elijah, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. Sometimes that's translated a soft whisper. King James translated as a still, small voice. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave to meet his God. All the spectacular events, the loud events, the crazy events, the ones that draw a crowd, the Lord is not in those. If we let them go by, if we live them, because we have to in our lives, we have to live the earthquakes and the storms of our lives. But if we realize that the Lord is not in them, we can continue to move to a place and create space for the still small voice, for the gentle blowing to come and connect with us. If we can do that, if we can find ways to merge the Mary and Martha experience in our lives, we are going to be able to let go of everything we think we have and think we need in favor of just being able to be. And to know that we are connected, to be able to make choices that transcend whatever we're feeling at the moment for the greatest good of the most people in our sphere at that time. That's kingdom. It begins and ends with silence. Silence is God's native language. We need to learn to speak it, not to get the revelation from God, but to let go of everything that stands between us and His grace, love, mercy, and presence. Let's pray. Father, I do want to thank you for the opportunity that Frank and I had to go away for a few days. But more, I want to thank you for the life that we have here, the lives that we lead every day, lives that are filled with relationship and laughter and sharing and watching each other's lives and the transitions and the transformations that are occurring all around us, the miracles that we see. Thank you for creating us in such a way that we can have our cake and eat it too, that we can have both things at the same time. Father, help us more and more to be able to merge the two, to desire something more, something deeper, so much that we're willing to act in different ways. Find ways to cultivate silence. Find ways to hear your still small voice. Father, we love you, and we know that you love us. We want to experience your love more and more each day. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for who you've made us to be in you. And help us never forget that we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.